small review of what we did yesterday, at least for the string, because there were a couple of things that I wanted to finish yesterday which we didn't get to. So it would be nice if we do it. So first, let me start by reminding you that we decided to study this action. We show that in order to have consistent equations of motion, we had to set the cosmological constant to zero. We also said that we were working in two dimensions, right? And then the Riemann tensor, just by looking at all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, we conclude that there is only one independent degree of freedom. So if we can cook up anything that looks correctly, that transforms correctly, or has the correct symmetry properties, then that would be it, okay? So if you can cook up something with a metric that does that, all we have to figure out is a coefficient in front, okay? So yesterday I got mixed the indices. Well, actually the indices were correct here. I just got them incorrectly here. So remember, as we were saying yesterday, what I think as Felix or somebody in the back reminded us, right? The Riemann tensor is supposed to be anti-symmetric in these two indices, and symmetric under the exchange of them. So if we want something that is anti-symmetric in these two indices, what we can do is to start with two copies of the metric and put these two indices, alpha and beta and alpha, with a minus sign, and then these two indices in the same place. Now, this object satisfies all the properties we want. We said, well, let's now try to compute what this guy is. So the first step, or after all, we want the Ricci tensor in order to see the equations of motion. So we have to contract with the metric, these two indices. And once we do that, what do we get? So we contract here, so we get a factor of 2, beta rho. And here, we just get beta rho back. So we just get 2 times beta rho. And this is the Ricci tensor. If we contract once again, okay, so we get that R must be 2W. Okay? So now from here, we conclude that W has to be 1/2 R. But now we found this here. Sorry, I have a 2 here. So when I contract it, I got another 2. So I got a 4 here. So I get a 4 here. When I plug this in back here, what I get is that R alpha beta, or beta rho, is actually 1/2 R H beta rho. And this is precisely telling us that in two dimensions, gravity doesn't have any dynamics. Okay? That's why we didn't get anything interesting from this term, and we decided to forget about it. Now, we said that in two dimensions, the metric, our wall shape metric, has 3 degrees of freedom. Okay? And we said that reparametrization invariance, or DFIO invariance, biased two functions, and Weyl invariance biased one function. So we could set, or we could gauge fix this guy to be whatever we wanted, and we made the choice of the flat metric, just because I think it was Eduardo who wanted to have the flat metric, or somebody who said that they wanted to use this one. So we tried to make people happy, so we decided to use it, and not a very complicated curve metric. And with this action, with this choice, with this gauge choice, the action simplified dramatically. The action became something like this. Yes?
It was a question.
Oh, sorry, sorry. Yeah. There is no 2 here. Yeah, yeah, sorry, that's it up. Yeah, yeah. So there is a 2 here.
Here.
Yeah, yeah. And then there is a 2 here. And that's what I wanted to write. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, even the second time I messed it up. Okay, very good. So here, this notation, I hope is clear, this notation means x dot mu is derivative with respect to tau. Okay? X prime of mu is derivative with respect to sigma. And the square is a contraction of this index. Remember, in the target space, these are coordinates, so there is a vector index here. So we can contract any two objects with a vector index with the metric in space-time, or in the target space, and we denote this like this. And if it's the same object, we just put a square. Okay? Sometimes it's not the same object, so we put a dot. So don't confuse this dot here with this dot here, but I think everything is clear here. Okay? We said that this looks like a free ride, but it's not. We have to remember to impose the constraints, which were that the energy momentum tensor has to vanish. So you have to compute the components and find what they were. And the constraints turn out to be telling us that this combination has to vanish, and this combination has to vanish. So these were the constraints. Now today, what we want to do is to explore the equations of motion when we vary with respect to x. Okay? So we have done everything with respect to the metric. We now understand, we can gauge fix it and so on. But now we want to see what happens to the field equations with respect to x. So that's what we're going to do. Now this action only depends on x. So we can vary the action. So when we vary the action, we get, so allow me to write d sigma squared for these two guys together. Okay? So what are we going to do? Well, when we vary, what do we get? We get 2 times x dot variation of x dot minus 2 times x prime delta x prime. Right? So now what's the useful trick to proceed? We have to find something that only has variation with respect to x. We don't want something that has an x dot or an x prime. So what do? Well, we put the dot outside. We flip the variation with the derivative, and we integrate by parts. So when we integrate by parts, what do we get? We get something that looks like so you can work out the factors, okay? That we will get something that looks like x double dot from integrating by parts the derivative with respect to tau. It will hit this guy once again. The same coming from here, and this will be proportional to the variation, okay? But as you know very well, there are boundary terms that we have to worry about, right? And the boundary terms come from precisely the integration by parts. So we're going to get a boundary term that is going to look like derivative with respect to tau of x dot delta x. And then here we're going to get something that looks like sigma x prime delta x. Okay? Now the integration region in the tau space, remember, is assumed to be non-compact. But in the sigma space, we assume that it's compact. It's just over a strip that we're integrating. Okay? So usually in field theory, when we have integration regions that are non-compact, we say that the fields or the variations decay enough so that we can forget about this term. But we have to concentrate on this term because we don't have the luxury. We have to worry about what happens on the boundaries. So let me bring back tau and sigma. So of course, from the variational point of view, we have to set this equal to 0, and these are the field equations. Okay? But We should also worry about this term. So let's try to see what this term is. So let's bring back tau and sigma. So d tau, remember, is an integral from minus infinity to infinity, and the sigma integral is from 0 to pi, but this is a total derivative. So we can evaluate this immediately and say that this object here is nothing but x prime delta of x evaluated at sigma equals to pi minus x prime delta of x evaluated at sigma equals to 0. But remember, we want to set the variation, the total variation, to 0. We already succeeded in doing this part by finding the field equations. Now we have to set this to 0. In how many ways can I set that to 0? Is that clear? That we have to set this to 0 now. Okay, those are the boundary conditions. Usually in field theory, you deal with R4, say, in regular field theory, and you don't have any boundary conditions. But here, we have a finite space in the sigma direction. So all I did was to integrate by parts. I pull out this piece here. And it's a total derivative in sigma. Therefore, I can carry out sigma integration by evaluating this at sigma equals to pi minus sigma equals to 0. Anything wrong? There's like maybe 25% chance there is something wrong. No?
I'm just not really following, but why does sigma go from 0 to pi?
We made a choice. Excellent question. There is no reason whatsoever. We just decided that we are going to model. Remember, our goal is to model these point-like particles as little strings. Remember, we're back in the 60s, and we're trying to model these interactions as little strings that interact and do crazy things and produce other little strings. So if we don't take this region to be compact, when we map this into the target space, this will be your blanket, right,
okay,
floating around. But we don't see we don't see a blanket floating around. In fact, one would have to choose all the parameters in such a way that really they match what we see in experiments, right? And that will have to do with what I'm going to say next, which is if we want to give the interpretation of this as a string, we will have to do something here. But let me not do it now. Let me just ask again. Are there any questions about this? Yes.
Why is this question? Let's go to
This is a usual assumption. We are studying, when we study field theory, we assume that the fields vanish at infinity. That's why we have to worry only about the compact part, which we don't usually do in field theory, right? When we work in R4, we just have all the fields decaying at infinity. But is the math correct? Yes.
How do you know you're able to say that they're separate to zero, like the equations of motion and the boundary?
Well, because this depends on sigma and tau, right? This variation. And this is only at sigma equals to pi and sigma equals to zero. So in particular, I can choose a variation where the variation happens to do nothing at the boundaries and do crazy things in between. Remember, this doesn't even have to be smooth. That's something that bothered people at some point, that quantum field theory is not in the realm of holomorphic functions and beautiful functions. But that's okay. I mean, the path integral is an integral over all crazy functions. So this is okay. So, well, when people did this, they were faced with these boundary conditions and they have to set that to zero. How can you set that to zero? Yeah, I hesitate about using this blackboard. You guys don't see very well, right? Up to where?
Yeah.
Okay, let's try that. Okay, so we have those boundary conditions. So, possibilities. Case one. We set x prime evaluated at any tau and sigma equals to pi, we declare that this is 0. That's one way to kill the first term, right?
Very good. Or we could also set the other piece to zero, just by imposing that this is true. Okay? Okay, that sounds good. So this is, these are possibilities at our disposal. And any of these two possibilities, choosing this or that to kill one or the other term, are called Neumann boundary conditions. Okay? But there is another choice. There are two factors there. So we could also choose these or these. Okay? Now, here you should have complained and told me, wait a second, this is a vector, so you should put a vector index. And here too. Okay? And these conditions are called Dirichlet. Now, all we want to do in life is to cancel those terms, is to set them to zero. So whatever way we can set them to zero is completely fine. Okay? But let's see the physical interpretation. In fact, we can even set different conditions for different components. Okay. So we want to map the string into the target space and see what happens. So imagine we have some target space where we have x1, x2, x3, and say x0 is not wrong. Okay. So we have this target space. Of course, there might be many more dimensions, but that's only kind of. Now, the Neumann boundary conditions are telling us that the ends of the strings, okay, can move freely in space, okay, and all we have to impose, the fact that the derivative with respect to sigma is equal to zero, is telling us that we don't allow momentum to flow away from the string at the end, at the endpoints. So in other words, the string at the endpoints have to move transversely. But otherwise, the ends of the string, of our open string, are free to move anywhere. Okay? So our string can move anywhere, anywhere it likes. Okay? So in that sense, we say that this string just lives freely in the target space. There is nothing interesting that it's doing, it's just moving freely in the target space. This is if we choose to impose this condition on one end and this condition on the other end. But what if we decide to impose some of these conditions on some of the coordinates? We could do that, right? So imagine we choose this condition on the x2 coordinate. And at some of the ends, so say sigma pi, we say that this is fixed to be some number, I don't know, square root of 2. All what we're saying, sorry, when we say that this is 0, it's saying that all this line, okay, the x2 component is a number, is a constant, which we can choose to be whatever we like, whatever your number is, your favorite number is square root of 2. Okay? Is it clear what I'm doing? At first, I think it gets a little bit complicated to get used to the idea of what we're doing, but remember, every point here is mapped to some point in the target space. Okay? And to define the map of that point, I have to tell you three coordinates in this example. Now I'm telling you that my boundary condition says that no matter where I am in this line, all this line is mapped along the x2 coordinates to the same point, square root of 2. So square root of 2 is somewhere here. Okay. So there is a plane here that seems to be special. It's a plane square root of 2.
all along this plane, any point has a fixed x2, which is x squared root of 2. Okay? So what happens in this case? Well, we're imposing a boundary condition on the string so that all this end of the open string is forced to always leave on this plane, and it can only move on this plane. Imagine that the other end of the string satisfies a Neumann boundary condition. So this guy can move around. He can do anything it likes. Okay? That's another possibility of boundary conditions. Now we can start doing crazy things, like, well, say that the other end of the string satisfies another boundary condition, say on x2, too. So we can draw another plane at x2 minus square root of 3. And then this point has to lie on this plane. We could also have strings where both ends are forced to lie on the same, have the same value of x2 all the time. Okay? The endpoints only. Remember, the remaining parts of the string are free to move everywhere. They don't do anything. Okay. Well, when we impose these boundary conditions, where something like this happens, we say that the strings are living on something that is called a D-brain. Okay? So, and the D stands for the boundary conditions that force the string to live there. Any questions? Yes?
So for the mute plus two component, you choose directly boundary conditions, but for the mute equals one component, you could choose
Neumann boundary conditions. Yes, yes. Very good question, yes. So I'm only choosing for the X2 component Neumann boundary, Dirichlet boundary conditions, and for all the other ones, Neumann boundary conditions. What happens if I also impose x1 to have Dirichlet boundary conditions? So let's try that one. This one and this one. So this one I have to choose some value. So x1, I choose some value, I don't know, 3 here. Now this is my plane, and my plane, x1 equals to 3, intersects this plane somewhere, okay, along this line. Now my string, or the end point of the string, is only allowed to move along this line, right? So you found an interesting point, which is a if all the conditions on the string are Neumann boundary conditions, the point can move anywhere in the space, so that's fine. Now if we impose, say, let's see how many we want to impose. So if we impose one Dirichlet condition, the string will have to move in a hyperplane in this space-time, right? So the hyperplane will have dimension what? What will be the dimension of the object? Suppose we're leaving the space-time has, yeah, this is unfortunate, because we're using D for Dirichlet, and the space-time dimension. Well, let's say that the strings are living in 26 dimensions. It has to be definite, right? 26 dimensions, which splits as 25 plus 1. If we impose one Dirichlet condition, the end point of the string can live in what? In a space that has how many dimensions? How many? 25 dimensions. Yes? Which splits as 24 plus 1, right? So we call the object where the string can live, we call it a D24 brain. Okay? If we impose two Dirichlet boundary conditions, okay, on two coordinates, the string will live on a D23 brain. Okay? So the more Dirichlet boundary conditions we impose, the smaller the dimension of the object where the endpoint can live. Okay? Well, let's not worry about this very much, because people didn't worry about that, because we don't see D-brains standing here and strings just attached to them. So people thought that these guys were not important, so they didn't worry too much about them. So let's follow the same logic and not worry very much about them. Okay? But I encourage you to play games and try to come out with crazy configurations. Yes.
So you can choose any boundary conditions you want that make that.
Yeah. I claim that these are the only ones.
Those are the only ones.
Yeah. You can set. You want to set this to zero and this to zero. So this is a factor. So you can set this to zero or this to zero, and this to zero or this to zero. Okay. So these are the possibilities. And on top of that, you can do anything, any combinations you want for the different components. So I encourage you to come out with a, yeah, maybe we can make a contest. Who can come out with the craziest configuration of strings with boundary conditions? Okay. Yes.
How come you're just not allowed to set the two equal to each other?
Yeah, setting the two equals to each other. Is not an option for a mapping string, right? Because if we set the two guys equal to each other, see what we're going to be doing, right? We're going to be identifying this line with this line, and then we will satisfy the boundary condition. In which case, we don't have any of this. We can forget about all this and say, and say that we forget about all those boundary conditions and simply declare that the endpoint at pi happens to be equal to the endpoint at zero. So these two terms will happen to be equal to each other. These two boundaries will be identified, and Trevor just discovered the closed strings. Which, in fact, is what we're going to study now. So we're going to solve the equations of motion, the field equations, assuming this boundary condition. And it will be an exercise for you to solve them using these boundary conditions. Okay? Okay. Yes, please.
Yeah, what does determine our target space dimension?
What is that?
What does determine the target space dimension?
At the moment, nothing. We just choose whatever number we like. So you can choose it to be 4, if you want, right? Because we're not drawing x0. We're only drawing 3 dimensions. So all the pictures you can draw are really just in 3 plus 1 dimensions. OK, very good. So let's solve these equations using these boundary conditions. So in fact, we're going to pretend that the string really extends everywhere, but is periodic in pi, in sigma, with a period pi. So what we're going to do in order to study the closed strings is to assume that our field configurations are periodic. In sigma with a period pi. Okay? And we have to solve the field equations. You, of course, know what this equation is. This is a free weight equation. And it's even simpler than the ones you have seen, because you have seen it in 4 dimensions or in 3 dimensions. And this is in 2 dimensions. So here, it's fairly easy to solve it, because we just have to realize that this is nothing but, let's use a notation del tau for derivative with respect to tau. So this is nothing but this. Or this operator factorizes. And this motivates us to make a change of variables. Okay? In order to solve this equation, it's natural to change variables so that this becomes a derivative with respect to the new variable, which we call sigma minus. And this becomes a derivative with respect to the other variable, which we call sigma plus. Okay?
Now sigma plus minus would be this is a change of variables. Okay. And it's an exercise for you to show that the metric in these new variables looks like this. Okay? Just use the change of variables and compute the new metric in the new variables. Okay? This is a metric on the world shift, so this is okay. Don't confuse this with the space-time metric. The space-time metric is still eta mu nu. Very good. Okay. Have you ever seen this change of variables before? Well, you probably have seen this. But this, in fact, has a name when we use it in a space-time and we mix the temporal component with the spatial component. In more dimensions, we usually use this trick as well, and we choose one of the spatial components to mix it with the space, with the time, like with the time component, and we make up something that are called, these are called life form coordinates. Okay, so that's what we are doing. I didn't tell you, but we are using, if you tell anybody, I'm going to be using Lycom coordinates, everybody knows that this is what you're doing. Now, very good. In terms of these equations, now it's trivial to find the solutions, right? That's remarkable about two dimensions. The equations are absolutely trivial. So x mu is something that depends on sigma plus and sigma minus. But in order to find the solution, a solution to this equation, all we have to do, really, or this equation is simply telling us that if you look at this object, right, this object doesn't depend on sigma minus, right? Likewise, if we permute the derivative, it's telling us that the object, the other object, doesn't depend on sigma plus. Okay, so let's do it that way. So this is another notation. It's yet another notation for the same things. This is telling us that this thing is just a function of sigma plus. It doesn't depend on sigma minus. Okay. And if we do it the other way, it will tell us that derivative with respect to x minus, to sigma minus, is only a function of sigma minus. Okay. But if we look at this, this is in fact telling us that this object is supposed to be periodic in sigma plus. Can you see that? Well, the reason is that x is periodic, a derivative with respect to sigma is periodic, and a derivative with respect to tau is still periodic. So this object is also periodic in sigma, or we can translate it as being periodic in sigma plus. Now, if we have something that is periodic and depends only on a single variable, what is the most natural thing to do? To use Fourier analysis, right? That's more or less it. The most natural thing to do. Now, look at the period. It's supposed to be pi, so we have to be careful about that. So we span over all Fourier modes. We call the Fourier modes alpha, for the lack of a better name, e to the I m sigma plus. But this is not quite correct, right? Because it's not periodic with period pi. We have to put a 2. And people like to put a minus. It's just by convention. So this is the most general function that solves these equations. Okay, we're just expanding in Fourier modes. Now, there is something I forgot to say, I said I was never going to do it, but I didn't do it, which was that in the string action, if we want to think about these axes, not as scalar fields,
They are scalar fields from the point of view of the world shift. But if we want to think about them as being coordinates in space-time, coordinates carry dimension, right? They carry dimensions of length. So the action, just written in terms of x squares, is not dimensionless. So we have to fix that, okay? So let me write it here. Remember the action, we ended up writing this like x dot square minus x square, right? If we want to treat these really as coordinates, they have dimension of length. So we have to put here, remember there was a half. So we have to put here something that has dimensions of 1 over length squared, length in space-time, just to make this a sensible action. And once again, remember, we're imagining that we are targeting our strong interactions. So people computed what this tension had to be in order for these strings to have a chance of being physical. And they determined that the tension, this is called the string tension, had to be 1 over 2 pi alpha prime. Do you remember what alpha prime was? We mentioned alpha prime at the beginning of the lectures. Alpha prime was a proportionality constant between? Excellent. Between the mass square and the spin of the particles. So that's what these guys were doing. And that's how T has to be in order to match the experiments. But of course, we now know that we're not doing that. But still, people keep this notation. So everywhere you will see alpha prime, even though we don't, it doesn't have the meaning, the original meaning. Now, this has dimensions of length in space-time. And we don't want the oscillators to have dimensions. So we have to put a length scale here, which is called the string length. OK. Very good. Now we can integrate this. Well, we could integrate this. Or we could also do the same thing for sigma minus first, which is exactly the same story, except that we have to impose that it's periodic in sigma minus. So we get this as a Fourier mode decomposition. Okay? A new set of oscillators, in principle, they don't have to talk to each other. Okay? Now we want to integrate this back. And when we integrate this, we expect to get a function that depends only on sigma minus, on sigma plus, and this a function that depends on sigma minus. So people like to talk about x mu that depends on sigma tau as a sum of two functions, one called xr that depends on your sigma plus, and one called x left that depends only on sigma minus. I'm not sure if I'm getting the r and the l in the correct places. Of course not. It's just to have the same convention that everybody uses. And oscillators here, people talk about them, well, over there, as right movers, and these as left movers. Okay? Very good. So we can now integrate this equation. So you see when we take del plus here, this piece cancels and only L is left. And when we take del minus here, this piece cancels and only R is here. So we can integrate this to compute what X, say, X left is. So when we integrate this equation, what do we get? Well, we get a constant. Right, a constant is allowed. So the small x is just a number, or a set of numbers. And now we integrate this. We have to be careful. Well, the zero mode, n equals to zero, is somewhat special. But the rest can be treated in the same way. So we get, if we want to get something sensible, we get something like this. For all n different from zero, alpha mu m divided by m e to the minus 2i n sigma plus. Okay? So if we take a derivative, we are supposed to get this. Okay. And I hope we do,
let's see, except that there must be a minus sign here, right? Very good. So we can now do the same thing for x right. Little guy here, plus alpha 0 tilde sigma right plus or minus I over 2 string length, the sum over all guys different from 0, tilde m mu e to the minus 2i and sigma 9. This is sigma plus. Sorry. Very good. However, there is a problem. Can you see what the problem is? If I add up these two functions to make my function x mu, is my function periodic in sigma if I add them up? Of course, there is no problem here. This is periodic. This is periodic. But if I add them up, this is a constant, so there is no problem. No problem here. How about here? So let's add them up. And say, well, there is no problem in the constants. There is no problem everywhere else. Let's check this guy. L string alpha 0 tilde mu tau minus sigma plus alpha 0 mu tau plus sigma plus the rest. How can we make this periodic in sigma? Looks like it's impossible if we cannot. How can we make this periodic? Well, there is a way to make it periodic. If we allow the alphas and the alpha tildes, zeros, to talk to each other. And not only to talk to each other, but to be equal to each other, right? So if we impose this, then sigma drops from this. And great, so we are back and have something that is periodic in sigma. So if this is true, then what we get here is, let's choose just one of them, okay? Okay. Any questions? Well, you could ask, well, is this the end of the story? Maybe I could ask you, is this the end of the story? Are we supposed to solve the field equations and be happy with that? Do you remember? We were able to simplify the field equations because we chose a gauge for the world sheet metric, right? And that in that gauge, everything, life became extremely simple. And look, we found the most general solution that we can possibly guess. But we should not forget about imposing the constraints. Right? So we are supposed to plug these solutions, okay, into the constraints and impose them. So an exercise for you is the following. Well, this might actually be part of the homework, so don't worry about doing it today. You can do it. Which would be to show that the constraints, the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, in fact, end up being the following. Of course, it doesn't matter if I put the whole x or not, but let's put left here. So this vanishes. This square is a contraction in space-time, remember. Okay. So the most general solution, we impose the constraints, and then we can declare that we are done with the classical description of the object.
Very good. Now it's an exercise for you to show that if you impose Neumann boundary conditions, this is satisfied. So we're going to impose on both ends. Okay. If we do this, we get something like this. This is a solution. And this is what you're supposed to show. So now, this is where I wanted to get. Any questions before we switch topics? Yes?
Can you maybe say something about the physical significance of these things? Like, what is a closed string?
Yeah, so what we're finding is that the most general solution happens to be it's literally, in space-time, it's literally a closed string with some oscillation modes. And depending on which alphas you choose to be, here we have chosen that we have found that any alphas will do, and any alpha tildes. Okay? You can choose it to be whatever you want. The higher the m, the higher the oscillation modes that you're choosing to excite on your string. Right? This is literally where you solve a string that is attached to two ends, imagine. Right? You have different standing modes. Well, this is a string that can actually stand by itself.
So how's it related to the particle?
How is it related to?
To the particle.
To the particle. Well, we're imagining that this string length, basically the length of the string, is so small that we think there is a particle, right? And different oscillation modes will be different particles. So when two strings with different oscillation modes come and interact, they can do crazy things and produce other guys with different oscillation modes. So that's how we think that two different particles interact and produce different particles, right? But in order to do that, we first have to quantize this object and see if really what the excitations, the quantum excitations are. Okay? Of course, what I said is not true, that we can choose these alphas to be whatever we like, because we have to satisfy these conditions. Okay? But once we satisfy those conditions, then they can be whatever we want. So in the open string case, it's literally that too. Different oscillation modes will correspond to different particles. We will think about them as being different particles. In fact, they will have different spin, and they will have different mass. So depending on the oscillation modes that we excite, the particles will have different masses. We will see next time how to compute the masses, the mass of the particles, or the mass of the string, depending on the oscillation modes that you excite. Okay? Any questions?
I think it's interesting to say that, well, I don't know if this is true, even that if you take the alpha prime to zero, you get back to what looks more like a particle again.
Yes, very good. So, that's right. So this string length will end up being proportional to alpha prime, and if you take the tension to be very, very high, remember that alpha prime is in the denominator of the tension, so the tension, if you take the tension to be infinite, the string cannot really, no matter how much energy you pump in, and try to excite oscillations, the thing will end up collapsing into something that is very, very tiny, and we think about that as being the particle limit of the string. But really, all those statements make more sense when we describe the quantum version of the string. Okay. But before we end today, and just so that you have some background for the tutorial, or at least so that the tutorial makes sense for you for what you're supposed to do today. Let me just change gears completely. We're going to be talking about something completely different at the moment. So your last chance to ask a question about this.
I'm not quite clear where the assumption that it's a closed string comes into that derivation.
Which assumption?
That you have a closed string.
Oh. Periodicity.
Yeah, but
that's that. I've been using that very, very strongly everywhere, right? The reason I'm expanding in Fourier modes, even the factor of 2, has to do with the fact that this has to be periodic with a period of pi. So the 2 will not be there. If it wasn't periodic, we would have to use a Fourier transform. Here we're just using a Fourier series. Okay.
And then in that equation, is that for an open
system? Oh, this is going to be for this. When you impose this on one end and you impose this on the other end, on every oscillator. Okay. So try that out, and you should get this. Okay, so what do we want to do now? Once again, we will pretend that we went back to the 50s with Young and Mills, and later on in the 70s. And suppose that in the 70s somebody told you, yes, that the algebras are great, they have an important role in physics, they are doing something very, very important. And then somebody tells you, well, but we know that there is even a much more special Lie algebra than all the other ones, and that is SO3,1, right? But now you know very well that SO3,1 is nothing but a particular Lie algebra out of many Lie algebras. So you tell this person, no, wait a second, SO3,1 is not that special. I mean, it's just one example of many, many Lie algebras. Then they would say, no, but these are the global symmetries in your spacetime. So the other Lie algebras appear as some what are called internal symmetries. But then somebody would say, no, but once again, I insist, this is nothing but a particular Lie algebra. So if you have two Lie algebras, right, like SU2 and then SU3, you probably have done, you have seen that people try to unify them as being sub-algebras of a bigger algebra, right? So that was the quest for unification. So you did some homework on SU5, right, as being something that tried to unify things. So people, the natural thing to do was to try and unify this. Okay? Imagine that this group and these groups could be part of a larger group and do physics with that. Well, mathematically, of course, you can put these guys in a bigger group, but the question is, does it make sense? Can you build a relativistic theory of quantum fields that makes sense? So here was the question. Consistent quantum field theory, unifying these things. And many people tried, because imagine, this would be the ultimate unification, right? So this would be spectacular. And in the 67, Coleman and Mandula, what do you think? Did they succeed or didn't? Or?
It proved to be possible.
Excellent. If you cannot find the thing, then the next best thing is to be the one who proves that it's impossible. Then you can also become famous. So in fact, they prove that this is impossible. The proof, I have to confess, is complicated. And I would like to encourage you to actually read it in Weinberg, Volume 3. This is Appendix B of Chapter 24. No, but I'm serious. So if anyone of you wants to read it and you want to discuss it with me, I'll be extremely happy. I think that would be an encouragement for me to actually go carefully through the proof. Okay? So I encourage you to try, and then we can discuss it in private. So this is Weinberg. Yeah. Okay. But as any noble theorem, it's a great place to start and see if you can find new theories out of that. How so? Well, because any theorem has assumptions. So if you can see the assumptions and you can try to relax assumptions, you can go and bypass the theorem. So one of the assumptions that they make is that whatever symmetries you have map bosons to bosons and fermions to fermions. Okay? Well, of course, you have to be crazy not to do that, right? Well, but if your goal is to go around this noble theorem, then you really have to do something extreme and then say, well, let me actually do it. And it turns out that if you do this, then you can bypass the theorem and you can build something that is larger than the Lorentz group, and you have found what we now call supersymmetry. Of course, this is not the way it happened. Yeah. Yeah, very good. This is in four dimensions. This theorem is proven in four dimensions. Okay. In fact, it's even trickier for massless particles. So I think it would be nice to study this theorem really, really carefully. Yeah. Now you have this. And this was not the way it was discovered. In fact, it was discovered through a string theory, because as we will see, when we try just the strings that we are studying, we'll only be able to produce bosonic excitations in space-time. So we will not get fermions. So people try to find fermions in space-time. So they decided to put fermions on the wall shape too. And it turns out that the only consistent way to put the fermions on the wall shape gives you something that is supersymmetric on the wall shape. And when you go to the space-time, in order to have a consistent string theory without tachyons, the only way to have it is by imposing something that projects the states in such a way that precisely this happens. So sometimes people like to say that supersymmetry is also something that string theory gives you as a prediction, because it needs supersymmetry in space-time to be consistent. Okay? But that's not something that we're going to worry about now. At the moment, we don't care about this, okay? About string theory telling us all this, because we still have a long way to go to get there. What I want to do, in order for you to do the tutorial, or to see why the tutorial will be useful, is the following. Is to stick to four dimensions. Okay? And say, not only that, we will stick to massless particles. Okay? And I'm going to teach you a game. And I hope you will play the game and try to find all the possible cases. So the game is the following. For massless particles, I hope you remember that particles are classified by their helicity. Okay. Now it turns out that we have seen this in nature, right? Or at least the standard model uses them. Well, the standard model also uses a scalar field, but it's not massless, so we don't know about this one. Now, we believe that there might be a graviton, so this is a graviton in four dimensions. We don't know if this guy is there, but we hope he's there. And Weinberg, let's just say W, he actually proved that all the guys here and beyond can never produce macroscopic effects. So that's a very powerful theorem. He did it in the 60s. He proved, just by looking at the soft limits of these particles, when the particles are very, very soft, he proved that these guys will not be consistent with microscopic interactions. So we don't have to worry about those. So it's remarkable. In one go, he killed an infinite number of particles, and he restricted himself to the set that we believe might actually be there, just from using theory. No experiments whatsoever, just from theoretical ideas. Moreover, yes?
What he showed that we cannot simply construct any microscopic interactions for particles with high helicity anywhere.
Yeah, no. Now, people also believe that, well, there is even another way to rule these guys out, is to say that these massless particles would be impossible to couple to gravity. Okay? But that's something more, even more complicated. But Weinberg's proof is very simple and it's very elegant. So I like that very much. So now what we want to do is the following. Remember, I hope you remember, that these guys have integer spin. We call the spin the absolute value of the helicity. And therefore, these guys are bosons. Okay? Now, these ones here, these are fermions. Okay? So if we want supersymmetry, or we want something that exchanges bosons and fermions, we need something that if we have a one particle state that has helicity zero, okay, we need an operator that acts on that part one particle state and produces something that has what helicity? Well, we need it to have at least half integer helicity. Okay? So we will introduce an operator that we're going to call Q that maps this into something that has helicity half. Okay? In fact, say 0 plus a half. Just to remind ourselves that this new operator Q increases the helicity by half. Okay. Now, if you add this operator on something that has helicity plus 1, you will produce something that has helicity 3 halves and so on. Well, we know that the adjoint of this operator, since we're doing quantum field theory, the adjoint of this operator will do something that looks like the opposite. Okay. Now, there is something funny here going on, right? Because we know this is a fermion. If it's a fermion, it must be a spinner. In 4 dimensions, it turns out to be a Biot spinner. Okay. So are you familiar with Biot spinners? And how about the notation alpha and alpha dot? No? OK. So when you have a Biot spinner of positive helicity, of positive chirality, there are 2 components, and people use the notation alpha for that. And when you have one that has negative chirality, so there are 2 chiralities, the opposite chirality, people denote the components by alpha dot. It's just a way of distinguishing the two ways of denoting them, of having the, just from the dot or the undot, you know the transformation of these particles. So we have whatever operator must carry that index because a scalar object doesn't have that index, okay? And this one will have to eat up this index, so it carries an index of this one. So the new operators will have to be Biot fermions in 4 dimensions. So here is the game we're going to play. Okay, let's see what we have. Well, we started 10 minutes later. Maybe 2 more minutes. 2 more minutes will be fine. Okay. So let me tell you what these guys are called. These are called supercharges. Okay? The Qs are called supercharges. Okay? And they satisfy they satisfy an algebra that looks like this, where these are anti-commutators. These are not commutators. These are anti-commutators. This, in other words, means that if you try Q1 and you try to square it, on any state, you will get 0. If you try Q2 squared, you will get 0. The same thing happens for bars. Okay. Today, in Beyond the Standard Model, you will see that when you commute these 2 guys, and this is the way these guys talk to the Lorentz to the Poincaré group. Okay. Remember, we wanted something that mixes the Poincaré group with a new symmetry. So the way these guys talk to the Poincaré group is that these guys will end up giving you something that looks like the Pauli matrices are 2x2 matrices. Now we denote the indices by alpha and alpha dot of the matrix, and the momentum operator is contracted here. Okay? So that's the way they talk to the Poincaré group. Of course, they are vial fermions, so under rotations, they have to transform as vial fermions. Okay? But this is not the game I want to show you how to play. The game is the following. I want you to build all possible super multiplets. What do I mean by that? We want to build representations. Remember the games we were playing with SU2 and building representations when we did Lie algebras? Well, we want to do the same thing with these operators. Okay? So, remember with Lie algebras we started with a singlet and then we tried to build something interesting, then with a doublet and so on. Well, we will do the same thing here. We will start with this guy and apply Q alpha to it. Okay? Well, let me not use this notation because you'll be confusing. This gives us something that has helicity 0 and helicity 1/2. Can I apply Q again to increase the helicity? What do you think? Right? No, because it's going to give us 0. So we have this guy here. Now, this is a scalar field and this is a vial fermion. But we know that in four dimensions, all the theories we know that they are consistent are CPT invariant. So under a CPT transformation, this guy goes to minus helicity. So we have to add something to make something that is CPT invariant. We have to add something that looks like this, where we start with this object and we apply Q to build this one. So putting these two guys together make up a super multiplet that is called the chiral super multiplet. Okay? We could also start with helicity plus 1. Well, or we can start with helicity 1/2, say, and apply Q to it, we get something that has helicities 1/2 and 1. Okay? But CPT tells us that we also must have minus 1/2 and 1. Now this is what we call a vector boson. So this is a gauge field, and this is again a chiral fermion. So this is called the vector super multiplet. Okay? So here is a game that I want you to play. I want you to keep trying this until you reach super multiplets that contain particles that are not allowed. Remember, the helicities are supposed to be less or equal than 2, or greater or equal than minus 2. But there is something else we want to do, which is that we want to allow not only one supercharge like this, but we want many supercharges. So we want n of them. And when we have many of them, we can start playing games of applying, of constructing longer super multiplets. Okay? So I want you to show that if you start with helicity minus 1 and you have 4 of these things, okay, and you apply them, your guy here. Now you can apply 2 guys because they don't have to be the same. Well, if they are the same, they will give you 0. But if they are not the same, they will not give you 0. So you can keep going. Okay? So how far can you go? You can go to the place where you have 4 guys here. And this guy will have helicity plus 1. So I want you to do this carefully and tell me how many states are there of each kind. So of helicity minus 1, there is 1. Of helicity minus 1/2, there are 4 of them, right? Because this index goes from 1 to 4. So you should keep going, keeping in mind that this guy is anti-commutative. Okay? So that would be important. And the last exercise would be to do it for n equals 8. Okay? And there you will start with a guy with helicity minus 2. And go all the way and show that for n equals 4, this supermultiplet is CPT invariant by itself. And for n equals 8, this supermultiplet is CPT invariant by itself. Okay? And now we are done. And the reason you're going to do the tutorial today is that at some point we will like to study theories that look like this and like this. And these theories are extremely hard to write down, but they turn out to be very simple to write down. Well, not very simple, but simpler if you actually go and interpret them as theories in higher dimensions. But in order to go to higher dimensions, you have to understand what the spinors are in higher dimensions in order to study supersymmetry in higher dimensions. And do the same things that we did here. So today in the tutorial we will study spinors in higher dimensions. And hopefully, hopefully by the end of today you will be able to tell me when you can have a Weyl spinor and at the same time the Majorana spinor. Okay? Which cannot happen in 4 dimensions, by the way. Okay, very good. So let's stop here.